the reason why Alaskans are responding the way we have is because there's no appreciable change in the threat level.
Alaskans respond to news about North Korea's new military capabilities. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, what smaller PFDs mean for rural Alaska.
It may not be so much to somebody who lives in the urban area who makes over $100,000 a year or $150,000, but for people like us, that's a big deal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs from office administration to water and wastewater treatment. Tweet hashtag careersbeginhere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
The Army says an Alaska soldier serving in Afghanistan has died. Private First Class Hanson Kirkpatrick of Wasilla died Monday in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, according to the Defense Department. He was wounded in what was described as an indirect fire attack. Two others were injured as well, and the incident is under investigation. Kirkpatrick was assigned to a unit stationed at Fort Bliss in Texas. Governor Bill Walker ordered flags in Alaska to be lowered to half-mast in recognition of Kirkpatrick. There's been a recent increase in U.S. military deaths and injuries in Afghanistan as the fighting season with the Taliban becomes more intense and American forces work more closely with their Afghan partners in the battle. Hundreds of U.S. forces, including the Marines, are in the southern part of the country. The news yesterday of a successful intercontinental ballistic missile test by North Korea has world leaders calling for restraint. Based on observations of the test, North Korea could potentially launch a weapon capable of reaching any part of Alaska. It's a major development in the arms race on the Korean Peninsula, but in Alaska, the news prompted more of a shrug than a shriek. There were no runs on stores or major signs of panic. An Air Force spokesperson for Alaskan Command at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson said they hadn't received any inquiries on the subject from the general public. An information officer with the Anchorage Police Department said the same thing. Ethan Berkowitz is the mayor of Anchorage, a city that would presumably be a main target in Alaska for a hostile missile strike.
I mean, the reason why Alaskans are responding the way we have is because there's no appreciable change in the threat level.
Though he spoke with military officials about the missile test, the latest development doesn't actually change any emergency response plans currently on the books.
We have complete confidence in the military to defend us, and we have the assurance that no matter what happens to us here in Alaska, we'll be able to take care of ourselves.
A statement from Governor Bill Walker's office expressed a similar sentiment, saying the test, quote, underscores why it's so important to increase America's military presence in Alaska. But amid relative calm from officials, some Alaskans were expressing worries on social media. One of them, Fairbanks resident Henry Cole, says this new development with North Korea feels substantial.
They can now get me. And so that's what makes me angry, because I'm now personally within, you know, the umbrella that their the radius that their missiles can reach.
Cole says in the event of armed confrontation, the Fairbanks area makes a pretty good target. It's a population center with the Trans-Alaska pipeline running right through it and two military bases of strategic importance. And just 100 miles away is the anti-ballistic missile defense system at Fort Greely by Delta Junction. But Cole isn't hitting the panic button. In fact, when we spoke, he was on his way outside to grill. He doesn't think the North Korean regime is very likely to start shooting toward the area, but he says he's frustrated by even the possibility after so many missed chances for diplomatic intervention.
That pisses me off. There have been opportunities to either act directly or to work with China, work with Japan, work with South Korea. And at least to my view, none of those have happened. And now, you know, they're sitting there with a big enough stick to reach out and hit us.
The timing of the missile test might have also contributed to the muted response from Alaskans. Charles Woolforth is a columnist for the Alaska Dispatch News and a radio host on KSKA in Anchorage. He says on a summer holiday, when weather across much of South Central was beautiful, people weren't too focused on the news, himself included.
Well, I was at the 4th of July parade in Seldovia, which is a town of about, I think, 200 people, when somebody said, hey, I heard that Korea tested this ICBM, and conversation didn't really go any further because everybody's out in the sunshine and watching the fish toss, and that just seemed like more of the moment, I think.
Woolforth says that in general, during the height of summer, political life in Alaska takes a back seat.
You know, once the fish start running, politics kind of, all the air goes out of it and people stop paying attention.
Woolforth also says that when he was growing up in Anchorage during the Cold War, they practiced duck and cover drills in school. It's not a new idea for many Alaskans to be within striking range from a hostile country. When the Alaska legislature passed the state budget on June 22nd, it also voted for the first time to limit the money given out as permanent fund dividends. By doing this, it followed in the steps of Governor Bill Walker, who cut PFDs in half last year to maintain state savings. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on how the PFD cut will affect some Alaska communities more than others.
Ben Nikuzik needs a snow machine to get around Hooper Bay, an 1,100-person city on Alaska's Bering Sea coast. He was planning on using his permanent fund dividend in October to make a down payment on a new one.
A lot of the families rely on the PFD, so they can purchase the big-ticket items, namely snow machine, outboard, or boat, because people just don't have that kind of money now. One lump sum, such as the PFD, especially on the good years.
And 2017 was going to be a good year. Years of investment growth were on track to push PFDs past $2,300. Without adjusting for inflation, that's the highest in the fund's history. But the legislature cut funding to 1,100. His household has 11 people, including his children's families and two foster kids. That means they'll lose more than $13,000. That's close to half of their household income.
It may not be so much to somebody who lives in the urban area who makes over $100,000 a year or $150,000, but for people like us, that's a big deal.
Hooper Bay is in the Kusilvak census area, where the average loss of household income would be more than 10%. That's the highest loss in the state. Juneau residents would lose 3%, the lowest loss. Nikuzik says he's frustrated the legislature enacted the funding cut without passing a plan to balance the state's budget in the future.
I wish they'd get their act together. There are so many smart people in Juneau, and I don't want to see our state go under too, but there are so many people who are down there who can put two and two together.
State Fish and Game Commissioner Sam Cotton was a state representative when the state started PFDs in 1982. He says lawmakers knew then that it would be difficult to reduce dividends once they were started.
There was a discussion then about someday there'd be a contest between getting rid of or reducing the PFD and having income taxes or other broad-based taxes. So certainly the expectation was if you had to reduce or eliminate them, that it wouldn't be an easy thing to do. It would not be a popular thing to do.
Cotton expresses sympathy for residents from lower income portions of the state who feel they're carrying the burden for balancing the budget. He says agreeing on a long-term budget plan is essential.
Then it might be fair to say, okay, we're going to find another source of income and reduce, not eliminate, the dividends as a fair approach. But if you reduce or eliminate dividends as the only measure, then that's not a fair approach.
And while opponents of an income tax have cited its potential effect on the urban economy, village residents are concerned about the PFD cut's impact on rural economies. Niall Aguchak also lives in the Kusilvak census area in Scammon Bay. He says everyone in the city of 474 residents will be harmed by the PFD cut.
I know that extra $1,200 would have been very helpful. When they're paying out $5 plus a gallon for heating and for running operations, which includes gas, you know, diesel and so on. You know, all of this adds up somewhere.
The House and Senate couldn't agree on legislation to draw from permanent fund earnings to pay for state government. House members say the plan and future PFD cuts should depend on adding oil and gas taxes and a broad-based tax. Senators reject that approach and say a permanent fund plan should be passed on its own. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what the state's planned suspension of a wolf control program could mean for caribou.
If anything, we may need those wolves to help bring the herd down.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The State Parks and Outdoor Recreation Division is turning to the private sector to manage 5 Delta Junction area state parks that were partially closed last week due to cuts in the agency's budget. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the division has begun soliciting proposals from prospective contractors to operate the parks.
Nancy Schooley Williams is a retired Delta school teacher who enjoys getting out in the summer and camping in the area's 6 state parks. So she was very disappointed last weekend when she went to her favorite park, the Clearwater State Recreation Site.
The bathroom doors are locked, and for some reason, the handle is taking off the water pump, so people can't even get water.
Williams was among many other unhappy campers and anglers and picnickers who'd gone to the Clearwater or other Delta area campgrounds over the long July 4th weekend, only to discover they'd been placed under so-called passive management, meaning they're sort of semi-closed, accessible but without any of the usual amenities.
I moved here back in 78. Basically, because of that campground, I feel like screaming and hollering.
Williams says she talks with a lot of tourists as part of her volunteer job at the Sullivan House, an old roadhouse in Delta that's been preserved and now serves as a museum of area history. She says the park's cutbacks are going to hurt Delta's tourism economy.
I'm always recommending certain campgrounds, you know, that are good. And now it's really hard to recommend any campground that doesn't have a toilet.
State Parks Superintendent Brooks Ludwig says the agency closed the 6 Delta area parks at the end of last week to accommodate funding cuts included in the legislature's overall state operating budget that was nearly $146 million less than last year's.
We had to wait to the very end of the budget cycle to see whether the money was put in, and unfortunately it wasn't.
Ludwig says the budget cuts forced state parks to shut down the agency's office in Delta and lay off the seasonal worker who took care of the area's parks. That was among 10 positions in Delta, Fairbanks, and Harding Lake that were cut this fiscal year.
These are the folks that do all the painting of the park fixtures, the cleaning of the toilets, the mowing of the lawns.
Ludwig says in response, state parks will try to contract out management of 5 Delta area parks and leave Fielding Lake State Recreation Area near Isabel Pass in passive management. He says the agency had to resort to contracting out 2 years ago when budget cuts forced reductions at parks around Sitka, and again last year when it cut funding for Valdez area parks.
Unfortunate. We can't afford to run them.
Ludwig says the contractors must maintain the facilities and keep them safe. He says they'll have to pay state parks a flat fee up front, and in exchange, it'll get to keep all the fees it charges park users. He says that'll likely increase the cost for those users, who may, for example, see the price of renting a space in the campground go up from $15 to $20 a night.
We've got some interest out there. You know, I've been contacted by at least 5 or 6 people that are interested in potentially putting in a proposal.
Ludwig says Delta area parks generate an average of $80,000 a year, most of which come from its Clearwater and Quartz Lake facilities. He says proposals must be submitted by July 21st and that State Parks hopes to award a contract by mid-August. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The state plans to suspend its largest wolf control program in the upper Yukon-Tanana area. It's targeted wolves in part of the eastern interior since 2004 and is scheduled to end after the 2017-18 season. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The state's long-running upper Yukon-Tanana wolf control effort is aimed at increasing 40-mile caribou numbers for hunters by reducing the number of wolves on the herd's calving grounds. But Alaska Department of Fish and Game Regional Supervisor Darren Bruning says recent years' field research indicates wolves are not the limiting factor.
Potential signs of nutritional limitations were identified, including decreased caribou birth rates and reduced calf weights.
A Fish and Game study published earlier this year says 40-mile caribou grew from 13,000 in 1990 to over 50,000 at last count, but that the biggest growth was prior to wolf control. Since 2004, over 1,000 40-mile area wolves have been shot from aircraft under a state intensive management program that's cost millions of dollars. Bruning stresses the program's scientific value.
The information gained through the research activities associated with intensive management are the most valuable product of the program.
The 40-mile area wolf control program demonstrates the problem with manipulating a complicated natural system, according to retired wildlife biologist Fran Maurer of Fairbanks. Maurer, a critic of predator control, says the state may find itself working in the opposite direction.
If a herd is reaching carrying capacity, it's imperative to be ready to reduce the number of animals on the land to prevent a precipitous collapse or crash.
Maurer is frustrated that the state hasn't already curtailed the 40-mile area wolf kill. Hunting can be used to thin the herd, but Maurer says it's ironic that the state may also end up relying on wolves to reduce the caribou to a sustainable number.
The concern is that we've already reached or are approaching carrying capacity, and if anything, we may need those wolves to help bring the herd down.
The Alaska Board of Game authorizes predator control based on fish and game recommendations. Outgoing board chairman Ted Spraker concedes wildlife management is not always a simple equation.
We all understand how complex and complicated these issues are, and it also takes time to understand if these trends are a one-year trend or is it just a blip. Or is this population actually moving up or down?
Spraker says environmental factors like climate change further complicate the situation. The state plans research over the next 5 years to look at what happens to 40-mile caribou after wolf control ends. Wolves killed in the state program have included animals based in the Yukon Charley River's National Preserve.
While predator control took place outside of the preserve, it did have an impact on the population and the makeup of wolf packs within Yukon Charley.
Preserve Superintendent Greg Dudgeon says some of the wolves lost were part of a long-running NPS study, which was halted due to the state wolf kill.
We did lose several years in what had been a 22-year long data set for wolves with home ranges within Yukon Charley River's National Preserve. We won't get that back.
A recently published article on the Yukon Charley Preserve Wolf Study details impacts of state wolf control in the 2.7 million acre preserve. Dudgeon says Yukon Charley resumed wolf research this past winter, collaring 7 animals to track. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Hearings about NSTAR's request for a rate increase recently wrapped up in Anchorage. South Central Alaska's only gas supplier wants to boost residential bills by 4.6% to pay for mostly infrastructure investments. But the electric utilities that transport gas on NSTAR's lines to generate electricity are arguing against how costs are split. Reporter Daisha Eaton has more.
For 3 weeks in June, about 24 attorneys and witnesses crowded into a hearing room at the Regulatory Commission of Alaska's offices in downtown Anchorage to discuss the minute details of NSTAR Natural Gas Company's request for a rate increase. Grace Salazar is the spokesperson for the Regulatory Commission, or the RCA. She says it's kind of like a court for utilities.
They are requesting to increase their rates, and so we are evaluating the reasonableness of that rate increase for residential and commercial customers.
NSTAR filed the rate case with the RCA last year, and the panel of commissioners heard it this June. The commission's job is to make sure the rate increase is just and reasonable for consumers. And the RCA also exists to ensure that utilities can recover their expenses with a reasonable rate of return. That's a big concern for Lindsay Hobson, a spokesperson for NSTAR Natural Gas Company. She says the rate increase would recover costs for about $70.5 million of mostly infrastructure investments since 2013. One big project the increase will help pay for is an upgrade to the company's Potter Gate Station.
We have twin pipelines that run across the Cook Inlet there, and the upgrades allowed us to physically inspect those pipelines, which is really critical for a system that's nearing 60 years of age.
The Alaska Department of Law argued the increase was too much at hearings on June 5th, highlighting a miscellaneous expenditure for more than $300,000, which includes things like pizza parties, barbecues, and donuts, pies for celebrations, ice cream, cake, and golf. Hobson says with 200 employees, they use parties to promote safety. Hobson says the miscellaneous expenditures also include things like safety gear for employees and safety-related advertising. She says it's a normal expenditure for any company providing employee engagement, which the company believes will result in better customer service. If the request is granted, average residential bills will go up by a total of 4.6%. That translates to $5.47 for the average residential customer, a portion of which, $1.92, has already gone into effect. So bills will go up $3.55 more. Several utilities that produce power from natural gas and use NSTAR's lines to transport it, including Matanuska Electric Association and Municipal Light and Power, argued against how costs are split in the proposed increase. JL Properties also weighed in against the increase. All interveners to the rate case were contacted for this story and declined to comment or did not return phone calls by deadline. The RCA is expected to make their final decision by September 22nd. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 6th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the National Guard Armory in Fairbanks. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Diane Shanker had recently graduated from Reed College and was living in Fairbanks when she heard a rumor that Welding Union 798 had been forced to hire women to build the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you a series called Midnight Oil about the state's complicated relationship with the pipeline. A 21-year-old with no experience in construction, Shanker convinced the union office manager to let her work with an all-male crew of welders from the South.
I wasn't worried about them not wanting me there because I was female. My biggest worry is that I really wouldn't be able to do it, that it would be too physically hard and that I'd oversold myself. And I didn't even know what a welding rod is. Unbeknownst to me, before I arrived, they had heard the rumor that they might be forced to have women on their crews, and they had made this big pact amongst themselves that if any female showed up, nobody would ever speak to that female. And so that lasted about 4 hours. They gave me this, what they thought was the worst job on the crew, which is crawling along on your hands and knees under the pipeline, a mile or so back from the rest of the crew, all by yourself, and picking up the spent welding rod. But they thought that was just the worst thing they could do to somebody. And to me, it was just, I loved it. I used to joke with the guys on the crew, you know, about all the guff they'd given me about, oh, you women can't do this work. And I would tell them, you couldn't wait tables for 5 seconds. I mean, I've carried more weight on a tray than I have to do in this job. The rule was, if you were a welder's helper, if you put in so many hours, then you got your card, you know, your union card. You got to join the union. And so when I had put all my hours in, I went to whoever was in charge and said, hey, I did it. I have my hours. I want my card now. And they said, no. He made it perfectly clear that I could keep asking about my card and he'd have me fired immediately, or I could just drop it and never bring it up again. And he said, you know, you might win in the long run, but meanwhile you'll be out of the job and all that money. You know, several of them actually came up and kind of grudgingly admitted that they didn't think women would work, and they thought it was great that I was working, and they kind of really dropped the animosity. They never dropped the pornography and the sexual references and, you know, the kind of day-to-day sexism, but they weren't mad or trying to get me hurt after that. You know, there was a lot of joking and horsing around and practical jokes, and one guy threw me in a little pond of water one day, and I told the crew, you know, you like to joke and kid around all the time, but don't throw me in the water because I don't know how to swim. And one guy threw me in the water anyway, and you know, it was scary for me because I really can't swim, and I had to struggle to get out of there, and the crew just ran him off immediately. I mean, that minute, he went back on the bus and was flown out of the camp. So, you know, they had kind of come around to being my friends.
Years later, Diane Schenker would testify in a lawsuit brought by the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission against Union 798 for discrimination against women and minorities. Schenker is now retired and living in Anchorage. The story is part of Midnight Oil, a new podcast from Alaska's Energy Desk. And to hear more, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. A statue of the U.S. statesman behind Alaska's 1867 purchase from Russia now stands in front of Alaska's Capitol building. KTOO's Jacob Resnick attended the unveiling of a bronze statue of William Seward.
The plastic cover was pulled down Monday afternoon to reveal a 6-foot towering sculpture of Secretary of State William Seward. The work of Ketchikan-based siblings David and Judith Rubin. It was erected to mark the 150th anniversary of the transaction that shifted Alaska from being Russian America to U.S. territory. The Juneau Community Marching Band struck up the tune as 21st century politicians honored the 19th century top diplomat, who was one of President Lincoln's closest confidants during the Civil War. Here's Congressman John Young.
You know, you've heard the history of Seward, but I'd like to just recite what Seward means to me. First, he made me a congressman. I want to thank him for that. But secondly, every time I fly into the state of Alaska, and I do this twice a month, and I'd be flying either southeast or up around the rail belt, into a barrel or somewhere, and I think, my God, what a place he did for us when he bought us for $7,200,000, is that correct? $200 million or whatever it was.
But Steve Haycox, a University of Alaska Anchorage history professor, noted that many who lived here in 1867 resented the transaction between colonial powers.
Tlingit and Haida leaders have rightly called attention to the fact that their ancestors were not included in the purchase agreement, despite their having a concept of property ownership.
He noted that 19th century diplomats wrote off indigenous claims, an official attitude that persisted for another century.
To my mind, it's appropriate that as part of the sesquicentennial celebration, we fully acknowledge Tlingit and Haida's sensitivity on this issue.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Malott speculated that Seward would have appreciated the negotiating skills of Alaska Native tribes when the Alaska Natives Claims Settlement Act was passed in 1971.
Like selling the Brooklyn Bridge, Alaska Natives sold Alaska again in 1971 for a bit more than $7,200,000, and that was for $1 billion and 44 million acres of land that we were allowed to keep.
The statue was largely made possible through private fundraising from individuals and corporate donors. It stands slightly below street level next to the Diamond Courthouse. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Daisha Eaton and Henry Leisha in Anchorage, and Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and Hillman produced tonight's show. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.